Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You're listening to the Companion Gun Dog Podcast. I'm your host, Grayson Geyer, and today we're doing something a little bit different. I am not with Emily, but I do have my friend Kevin Stump Grant on the other line with me today, and we are going to discuss the importance of wild birds in training dogs, and we're going to talk about a few other things that we have on the horizon, projects we're working on together. So how you doing, Kevin?
Doing great, Grayson. Good to hear from you.
It's weird calling you Kevin, so I'm just going to call you Stump.
Yeah, please do. Please do. It's weird being called Kevin, unless you're my mom or grandmother or wife.
So for those that don't know, Stump is a fishing guide out of Pawleys Island. I'll let him fill in the rest of his credentials, but he's been a good friend of mine for, gosh, I guess going on 7 or 8 years now. And we've spent quite a bit of time traipsing around the countryside, hunting birds, chasing our little dogs. And so I'm excited to kind of share the air with him tonight. So Stump, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, man. Born and raised in Hartsville, South Carolina. Lifelong outdoorsman. Grew up hunting and fishing just about everything available to us here in the Southeast. And as I've gotten older, I truck around the country chasing everything I can here and there. But as far as an occupation, I'm a fishing guide, inshore saltwater fishing guide out of Pawleys Island, South Carolina. I've been doing that for 15 plus years now. On top of that, I do some bird hunting. Duck hunting, kind of a thing of the past for me, but still occasionally got a duck hunt or two, and spent some time doing that out in Mississippi back around 2000, late 90s, early 2000s. And then I've always had bird dogs. I've had a smattering of different dogs over the years, all gun dogs of some sort. And ended up landing on these French Brittany's, and that's what brought you and I together, and I guess leads us to this phone call today.
Yeah, that's it. I certainly don't blame you for quitting that duck guiding game, man. That is a cutthroat business. I see that all over the internet these days. It seems
Yeah, for us, it was wild birds, and, you know, and so wild birds, it's give and take. You never know what you're going to get. It's real dependent on weather, but now there are just a lot more guys doing it, younger guys. It's a lot of work for little reward, wild bird hunting coastal South Carolina. I won't say that it's not worth it, but for me, it was great to have done in my younger years, but I've got better ways to spend my time now.
I feel you. And I mean, and to that point, even with what we do, man, I had a program this year. I've always wanted to like take people hunting and introduce them to it. And I've got clients that are in desperate need and they want it bad. But even still, when you explain to them ahead of time, like, hey, I'm going to take, you know, and what I did this year is I took everybody to these, you know, we just prospected cover. There were no honey holes. And I was like, I can't even guarantee we're even going to find the kind of cover I think we're going to find. I'm just doing my best to kind of cyber scout at first. We go prospect a new place and they're all on board. They know exactly what to expect. You take them and you get skunked and it still feels just as bad as anything you've ever done in your life. It's terrible.
Well, you know, yes and no to that. As I've grown as an outdoorsman, and we can kind of touch on what the graduation of that is, and I don't think this is not common knowledge, but when you're young, you want to kill your first one. Then you want to kill more of them. Then you want to kill as many of them as you can. You want limits. And then after that, you learn to enjoy the hunt and appreciate it more. And it becomes a lot less about harvesting an animal and more about the experience. And I went through that as a professional fishing guide, too. And I have learned, and what the way I market myself now is not as a fill the cooler type of fishing guide. Mine is more about the whole experience together, us going out, enjoying nature, learning from one another. You know, a lot of times from novice anglers, for me, it's teaching them how to cast and that sort of thing. But you know, there's always stuff you learn from individuals when you spend time with them outside, whether it be in the boat or the woods. And I also, to add to it, there's a responsibility to the resource once you've done it well enough to become adept at it, whether that be catching fish or harvesting woodcock or ducks. And it didn't sit right with me taking individuals who hadn't done the work or paid their dues and putting them instantly on success. I didn't feel good about it about myself. I didn't feel good about what it was doing to the resource. And so I think there's a lot of merit to you guiding guys like that, not taking them straight to the birds, but taking them on a walk in the woods and discovery and showing them what you look for and figuring out a cover together. That gives you a sense of ownership and reward that you don't get if somebody drags you right to the prize.
That's really well said, man. I mean, even just listening to it now, even though it's probably a conversation we've had a dozen times, it's something about just hearing it said back and you say it so succinctly, that it kind of hits home every time, you know, and it is a struggle. We all, you know, I think at this point now I get most of my joy in seeing other people figure things out, lights come on in dogs and people. And, you know, and I do hope this is doing it the right way. I mean, I still got tweaking to do with this, and I'm not sure how I'm going to proceed with it, but it's, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have a responsibility to the resource. We got a responsibility to the culture of what we're doing, you know, and we're living in a time, man, where, you know, it's everything social media driven. The internet makes the exchange of information so easy that it really is like cheating, you know. It's even still, you know, and I struggle with it, you know, definitely.
Yeah. For the video gamers out there listening, it's like having the cheat codes to your game. You know, what fun is that? What challenge is it? And what reward do you get in bypassing that? And you touched on culture. And, you know, influence, and I talk about it in a lot of aspects of life, and with a new career I've got going, influence is a huge part of what you do in the course of your daily life, whether it be, you know, just being polite to someone on the street. But when you take it to a level where you've put them in the pickup truck with you, you've helped train their dog, you developed a relationship with these people over time, you've got their ear, they respect you, they're first timers to the woods. And you start them off on that right foot of being conservation minded, fair chase, fair play, you know, to be able to plant that seed in someone and not have them take off and get that game hog mentality. Like you said, we owe it to the culture.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I mean, I think, you know, I had influences early in life, and I know you did, and some of them good and some of them bad. I mean, even, you know, some of the older men, when you say game hog, I can think of a few, you know, that had been at it for a long time. And I guess there was a different, you know, that we didn't have that free exchange of information back then. And you know, I think maybe we can forgive some of those old guys from our past for the way they saw things, because they just had what they had to rely on in terms of their upbringing.
Yeah, well, it was a sustenance culture back then, too. It was a completely different day and time. Sure. Hunting wasn't just a sport for those guys. You know, they were eating everything that they were taking back then, and they were working hard. It wasn't necessarily something they did primarily for fun. You know, and our grandparents, I don't think apologies are necessary for some of those guys. Of course, there are some, but you know, I'm guilty of it too. I was that young man I described a little while ago. I wanted to kill my first one, then I wanted to kill a bunch, and then I wanted to kill all of them. And then, you know, one day I saw just how it just wasn't important. It wasn't important anymore. That wasn't for me. That was to impress someone else. I was getting my pleasure well before I ever pulled the trigger. And once I realized that, it took a lot of pressure off, and it adds a lot more enjoyment to every time you do pull the trigger.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. I mean, I guess we can, we could probably spend an entire hour just on this topic, because it's something that I think we're all kind of on our own path with this thing, you know. And I,
that's right.
You know, I was raised outdoors, but certainly not immersed in the culture the way you were in your neck of the woods. And that's one reason I love visiting you down there is, it seems like everybody, you know, at least all, your entire cohort down there, they still have that connection to the sustenance hunting and fishing background. Even though we all are doing it for sport these days, you know, it's so much more of a social event, you know, when you finish a day on the water or hunting or whatever, and you get everybody together and there's a lot of cooking and stuff involved. And we have a bit of that, but it's certainly not to the extent that you do. And, you know, and I think it helps. It helps you kind of advance your station in our little, you know, culture.
Yeah. Well, man, we're fortunate down here, that hunting and fishing are our social culture. And we're still a sustenance driven community down here. You know, all these guys, we're processing venison every year. If we shoot something, we're harvesting it. And we do, we get a taste for doves, and we have these huge dove hunts and dove cookings. But there's a lot of social gathering involved with it around, and chance to share fellowship and faith and just good conservation ethics, man. The kids are involved. So it really is. It starts with you from the time you're old enough to go into the dove field. Kids around here are first retrievers. You know, you get to see them at 3 and 4 years old out for a couple hours. Then in the blink of an eye, they're carrying a shotgun, a single shot 410, and they're shooting a few for themselves. And then you blink your eyes again, and they're driving their dad out to the field. And so that's kind of the way we were all brought up down here.
Well, yeah, and it's a wonderful place, and you know, the entire state of South Carolina, and then you can break it down regionally. And you know, I know where you are now, down there around Pawleys Island, it has its own flavor. But even around, you know, especially around Hartsville, I love visiting you at both places. But you know, they're similar, but there's just little regional variations, but all very intense outdoor culture. So, you know, a lot of fun. I, you know, it's kind of a place that I look forward to getting to now and then, and I'll be fishing with you here in another month or so, and already fired up about that.
Yeah, that's starting to fire up now. These warmer temps have given us a little bit of an early spring. The pollen's been rough the past 2 weeks, and temperatures have been up and down, but it's got the fish moving. They're trying to get in and get into the spring pattern. And we got one more cold snap this week, and fishing should really take off.
Yeah. Yeah. The greenhouses around here, everything's ready to go in dirt, but it's, you know, we know we're going to get everything, at least probably one more good hard frost, if not a couple here, and probably this week. So everybody's itching for it, but it's not quite there. So we'll just wait with bated breath. But I guess it's important for us to actually get onto the topic that I will, that I've told the folks that usually listen to this thing we're going to discuss today. And that's the importance of wild birds in the development of a young gun dog or an old gun dog or a puppy or whatever. And the reason I've got you on this call is because that's your game. You know, you probably spend more time traveling and hunting than anybody I know. And we, as we kind of alluded to earlier, there's plans for the coming season to get out and get maybe some dogs that aren't your own out in the field with you. You know, we don't have to get right into that program, but give us a little bit of a background of kind of what your experience is in terms of traveling and hunting, what species you like to hunt, and then what you think you get out of it for the dogs.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll start, I'm going to back up just a hair and go on to that. I'm a French Brittany owner and have not always been. And the way I trained dogs in the past was a much more, direct and forceful manner that I tried to impose on the dog. And that was just, youthful drive and ignorance. And not that I've lost all of that, even at this age. But what the French Brittany's taught me is that forcing a dog, they were more inclined to shut down to learning if the situations were forced and set up and contrived. And they're just sharp little dogs and they don't take a lot of pressure. And so methods that had worked for me on other dogs were causing me some grief with these French Brittany. So I had to back up and reapproach it. And still in the start, I used liberated birds because that was available to me. And we had woodcock too, so I was able to use them. But a woodcock doesn't behave totally unlike a liberated quail in that they hold really tight for the dogs and allow them to get a little closer than what you're going to need them to get on the birds out west. And we'll get into that in a minute. Remind me to speak to that. But
sure.
So my style of training went more from some sort of imposed training setup that I had planned to an organic type delivery where it's just a series of exposures for the dog. And then you reward him when he's done well. And when he has it, you just back out and, you know, move to the next one. And you have to use some setup stuff to coach into that. But most of it was just a series of exposures to, as a young pup, to different terrain, to water, to live birds, to dead birds, and to the point where you're not training these dogs, you're just exposing them to it. You're training them to learn, and they don't even realize it just by sure. Repetitive. And I'm sure you could touch on all of this better than I can. But for me, it was just exposure to the young dogs, a little quick retrieve with the dead quail out of the freezer once or twice. And then you move that to the yard with the quail on the string. And then you move that out to the country, into the woods. And then as soon as you can, get as far away from those liberated birds as you can and get into the woods. And back to the woodcock, holding really well, he can be a great bird for a young dog because he'll put up with some stepping. He'll just give him time. He's not going to flush far. If you don't shoot him, he'll likely be within 100 yards of where you found him today, tomorrow. But to answer your question and why wild birds to me are important is because they just, once your dog is old enough, the wild bird will teach the dog what it needs to know. I have an idea for a training guide for new trainers and old trainers alike. And it is simply a map of some wild bird locations and a roll of duct tape. And the duct tape's for you.
Yep.
You put that over your mouth and you take the dog out hunting birds and the birds will show them. The birds won't put up with them getting close. They're going to flush on their own. They're natural. You're not relying on launchers or birds that are just running and wiggling into the weeds and getting wet, not flying, and your dogs are catching them. They eliminate all of that. And there's an intensity that comes from a wild bird exposure that you'll never get out of a pigeon or a liberated quail.
I agree 100%. And I'm sorry to interject.
No, please do. I was getting lengthy.
I want to pause for a bit because I think we're in a good place to kind of to sit on woodcock to discuss, you know, that transition because I use the same transition. I mean, woodcock for me and I've discussed it at length on this podcast. You know, they're kind of number one. They're the main quarry. That's what we have access to down here. Probably at least on a more regular basis than anything else. I mean, we can find some good quail spots and you know, a few good covey contacts really go a long way. But, but as far as, you know, my general progression, it is young dogs, pen raised birds. I always talk about making a monster out of my puppies. You know, I don't care if they're bumping and chasing and catching too much on those pen raised birds, at least early, because at least they're becoming a predator and a hunter. And that's what I need first. And, you know, I go in and I've gone in pretty decent depth to this point about what my progression on pin-raised birds is, but I wanted to wait for this podcast to get into that progression to wild birds. And so, you know, around here, we start seeing woodcock as early as, I'd say, mid to late November, probably even earlier, but that's about as soon as I'm going to be getting in the woods thinking about them. Unfortunately, you know, I never seem to get into the groove until we're closer to the season in terms of getting my dogs in the woods. And that's something I could do more of just for those contacts, whether or not I'm shooting the birds. But to your point, they're kind of like, they're a perfect step between a pin raised bird and your harder species to handle. Namely, you know, I'd say covey quail, rough grouse, your prairie birds, not counting your pheasant. I kind of see the pheasant as almost its own entity that a dog really needs to kind of figure out in addition to other types of game birds.
And, absolutely.
And, you know, and grouse could kind of be fit into that mold as well, just because they're so tricky. But pheasants really, they kind of, just with all the running and the getting into the super dense cover, they just pose a completely different set of problems, you know, for us that are out there chasing wild birds. But yeah, that's, you know, to me, woodcock are that perfect step up directly after your pin raised bird contacts.
Yeah. And what I kind of like about them, I like a lot about them. One, I think for training purposes or starting a young dog on one, is that bird's going to hold pretty tight. And if it will allow you quite often to get in there and do a little dog handling or adjusting or styling up, you know, if you're using it for training purposes, that bird will be a lot more tolerant to you making a correction, blowing a whistle, or even grabbing a check cord. Or that sort of thing. You know, you may get a chance to finish a sequence with a wild bird, with a dog, where you're not going to with huns or quail or sharpies or anything else.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, rarely am I going to find myself in a situation to get, I mean, you more than I, because you tend to have greater densities, and I'll find them in, you know, the kind of the game in my neck of the woods, and I'm only a couple hours northwest of you, at least from Hartsville, and about 3 hours northwest of you from Pawleys, or four. But we just tend to get little pockets that may hold, you know, quite a few birds, but you may walk for a couple of hours to a half a day in between finding your pockets. We're down there, I think you tend to get a little better distribution, just more even distribution, and which may give you more just straight up training opportunities, being ready to get on your gear, you know. But I think it's a great place for, yeah, you can set, in my opinion, set most of your stuff aside and do most of your training with your shotgun, with a woodcock. You know, you just pull up and your dog bumps and chases, you don't shoot it, your dog handles the bird, you give it a shot, you know, and whether you hit it or you don't, you're kind of setting a bit of a reinforcement schedule. You know, you do what's expected of you, and you get rewarded with a shot bird.
Yeah. Well, you know, on the map, your place, in Winston-Salem is almost directly north of my place in Hartsville. I mean, almost a straight arrow shot for about 2.5 hours. But in that area, you change from, the foothills to the sand hills to the coastal plain.
Yeah, through
and so your
range.
Pockets of birds are going to be around your creek draws and any place that does bucket out and make a swamp bottom. Down yeah. here, the whole place is a swamp bottom.
That's a good point.
Most of the timber has to have drainage and stuff cut in it. And those drainage ditches inevitably block up to some extent or another. Or even in these big pine forests that we have, they get skitter tracks in them in the beginning. And there's Carolina bays and just... there's just high water table in the soil content this way. So there's standing water everywhere, and that promotes the exact type of cover that they want. And so there's more opportunity for those birds to be here, and you don't have to go as far to look. So it what that does to apply for training is, now October and even early November, ticks and snakes are still a real issue down here. So getting in the woods early, and a lot of times too on our public and private lands, that time of year is when the rut is going on and the deer hunters are out. So training on them early South Carolina, unless you got private lands, those are the things you're going to run into. Hunters, ticks, snakes, and warm temps. And the birds not really being here yet. It's usually November when it starts to get cool. When things up north start freezing up, those birds, they seem to just kind of follow that freeze line. And although some of them will just get up and boogie on down here.
Sure.
But it's usually associated with a hard freeze up north.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I tend to observe is as far as the calendar birds, to me, it always seems like the big girls show up early and the males tend to kind of come in on the frost line and whatever other birds, you know. But if I do find any birds in the early season before we've had any weather up north, it always seems to be the what I guess is the breeding hens. And I don't know if you experience the same deal. But later in the season, I'll start finding the males, just the smaller birds in general.
Yeah. You know, and I often wonder if those females have just continued on, you know, and gone further to Chafalaya or Florida to their nesting areas there. But I know that some stay here because by the end of the season, we're seeing, mating behavior here. In the January, we're seeing birds starting to display, flying and painting at night.
Same.
Yeah, I didn't mean. I guess we've gotten off track on the woodcock a little bit.
I think it's good content. I think people are interested in this kind of thing, and it is. You know, it's. I mean, these are. You know, I mean, it's what I consider. You know, it's my favorite bird because it's what's accessible to me, but I also just have a real deep interest in them because I observe more of them than I do anything else, you know, and I've got a little bit of a romance for them, if that makes sense.
No, me too. I mean, they're a neat critter. And yeah. That's the reason I'll tell you, as the years have gone on, I shoot fewer and fewer woodcock. And when I guide clients on them, and I tell my clients this openly and willingly, that from the moment we leave the truck, I'm pulling for the bird, not for you. I'm not going to make it easy on you. And we're not going to walk them down after the initial flush. You get your one chance. And if you get him, great. I'm glad for you. But if you don't, I'm also glad for that bird. And if you come back again, we can likely find that same bird in that same drain.
Well, and I think that more than anything else I've ever hunted, woodcock kind of lend themselves to that, to a high degree of sportsmanship, because like you said earlier, I mean, they're not a terribly hard bird to hunt. Once you kind of figure out where they are, they're really easy on the dogs and they're, you know, they're not the hardest sometimes. Well, I mean, it depends, you know, depends on the cover and depends on that specific bird, whether or not it's going to be an easy shot or not. But oftentimes they're not the hardest bird in the world to hit. And I think they're just, you know, you can make a game meal or two every year and really relish in that, but it's not, you're not going to put a ton of them on the plate at the end of the day and make a big meal out of them. So really, I think they just really lend themselves to the sport and enjoying the sport of it and teaching people how to appreciate the sport as much as, you know, harvesting the quarry.
Well, and back to the point, as a training resource, you know, you and I sold a dog. I can't remember the gentleman's name, a pup that we bred. We sold to an individual and he started woodcock hunting and shot a bird this year that was banded 2 years ago, like 30 meters from where it was banded, and had flown to Canada and back 2 years straight. And was within 100 yards of where he was banded 2 years ago. More evidence that these birds are using the same covers year after year, and will be there for you to train on if you don't shoot them all.
Well, and the guys up north are getting them. I mean, they've been, you know, I've been seeing all sorts of cool reports. One guy in particular up in, I think, like North Central PA had like 96 contacts the other day. You know, and he's a dog trainer. He's not there to beat up on the birds. They're just training blank guns in the woods. Yep. You know, but he knows his holes, and that's a whole bunch of birds.
Gosh, we don't get days like that, man. Like, you know, a dozen birds in a 3 or 4 hour hunt, 15 birds is like a really good day for us in a 3 or 4 hour hunt. And you could do that twice a day. You could get to 30 birds a day. But we usually don't stay after them that hard, morning hunts or afternoon hunts.
And how can you argue with that? I mean, it, you know, especially for me that I kind of cut my teeth trying to grouse hunt in the mountains in North Carolina. And, you know, if I'd get a contact every three or four hunts, I was feeling pretty good about myself. So, and I would put the miles in, you know, and so there's people that do better than that up there. And I've never gotten to that level, you know. I think it's just knowing where they are. But yeah, to be able to have the woodcock where you can go out and expect to, you know, expect to find them and expect to find a handful of them. It's so good for the dog, and it's so good for, you know, just your general attitude and enjoying the hunt. So it's nice to be able to get into your birds, but to that point, it's so much nicer when you go out to a place you've never put your feet down and you move that bird, you know, that you didn't for the first time in a new place. That's the best feeling, in my opinion.
For me, man, there's a total, you know, people talk about escaping when you fly fish, and I do that too, and I get that same thing. But when I step out of that truck and I break that edge cover and I take the first step into woods, you know, any woods, but new woods in particular, my sensory levels are at an all-time high. I like to navigate naturally when possible. I'm not in there to stare at my phone. I pride myself in a woodsman as being able to find the truck again. I'm smart enough to have a backup plan there too, and sometimes have to use it. But I get lost in the moment. I mean, the hunt, the natural hunter in me comes to the forefront, and I'm not thinking anymore. I'm just doing. I'm weaving my way through the cover. I'm paying attention to where the dogs are. I'm looking and listening. I'm, you know, breaking down the cover, reading the ditch, which way's the water flow going. Just so much, you know, so much. You appreciate what's in front of me, the different timber, the different types of covers that you'll get from your region to mine, or from Michigan to Minnesota, Maine, all the different covers that they offer, different terrains, are all part of the experience and why I like to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm listening to you right now and just smiling and thinking of that same feeling. And I'm sure everybody else that's hearing this is doing the exact same thing. Cause, you know, I mean, that's well, at the end of the day, that's really what you're hunting for.
That's right. It took me a while to figure that out. But when I would rush out and shoot a limb of the birds in an hour and then be like, well, what do I do with the rest of my afternoon? You know, Emily's not here to keep us straight, and I'm sure she'd want us back on track. The woodcock is a good transition bird from your pen race, from your pigeons and your quail. All right, then the woodcock. That's because that's what we've got, so we take advantage of it, and it's a great bird for it. During that, I'll be doing some dove hunting and stuff too. My EBs all fetch land and water. That can cause a little bit of trouble when you're steadying up work too, and you're doing a bunch of retrieving all at the same time. I'll let Grayson coach all that later. But then by that point, I'm looking to go north or west. Kansas is great. They've got an early prairie chicken season. Those can be kind of tough on young dogs, but it's great to take these dogs that I've kept in cover and had hunting at 40, 60 yards all winter. Now I get to get them out into some prairie situation and let them start hunting and finding objectives that you don't necessarily have in a South Carolina swamp. The whole place is an objective. When you get out into the grasslands, you know, a harvested wheat field may have a plum thicket at one end or something like that. So then you get these young dogs out stretching their legs, and then they get to start using their noses from a little bit of distance. And quail are great for that. Prairie chickens, not so much. Early season ones will hold, and the cover's usually still pretty good out there then. So that can be fun, and it's good exercise for you and the dogs to get your season started. While quail season's not in then, you'll still run into them. So to me, that early Kansas, for the dogs, early Kansas quail, prairie chickens is going to be way better than going up north and hitting the woods for those wily ass grouse.
Yeah, those rascals, they take.
They're tough, man. They're tough. You want your dog pretty dialed in and with a good long nose and some level of intelligence on grouse. And I don't have a lot of that in my box. I got some pretty hot little runners, and they hunt short nosed, and they, you know, they crowd their birds. And I mean, they're getting better at grouse, but it has to be the perfect situation. And we have also spent a good many years hunting Wisconsin and figured out some stuff on cover and terrain. Again, I've gone at this naturally. I've never asked anybody to hotspot me any locations or anything like that. You and I went on our first trip 7 years ago or more to Wisconsin, and we took a map and we got out on the roads and we rode and we walked. And so I continued to do that for a while until I realized we just started stumbling into good cover.
Yeah, we were driving past a bunch of great cover to get to the spot on the map that we had marked.
Chasing the map, going to drive 30 miles to get to this fresh cutover, and we drove past 15 miles of fresh cutover on the way to it.
No, yeah, you learn when you travel like that. And you know, I want to while you're on the prairie birds, and so I guess, you know, what I'm getting from it is you think that for that young dog, that next good step from a woodcock is to hit the prairie. And either whether it be Kansas for chickens and quail, or, you know, what other states out west, I guess, is where I need to go with this. Have you ever been to like Nebraska or I don't know what else is great.
So here's the deal. The further east you stay, the less you stay away from those pheasants.
Yeah.
So the quickest places you can start hitting quail, Mississippi Delta, Arkansas, Mississippi, there's private land stuff there. But not a lot of guys are doing it, and they don't have a lot going on that time of year. Their duck season hasn't started yet. Their deer season's not in yet. So those are good places. What I like about, we'll call it prairie or any short grass situation. Here in the South, our quail, it used to be an edge cover bird, but there's not a lot of edge cover in our ag fields anymore. So these birds have moved into swamps and pockets and heavily grown pastures and woodlots. And with a young dog, you can't help them if you can't see them.
Yeah.
And so when you're just introducing this dog to wild birds, they're still making young dog mistakes. And sometimes they need a collar correction or just a, you know, whatever your style of training calls for. But you can't help them if you can't see them making the mistake. So if you get to the prairie, you got an opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, we're finding, I mean, there's still bob whites in our neck of the woods. People will tell you there's not, but most of those folks are telling you they're not because they're just not willing to access those birds.
They're in thick, tough stuff. You need a coon hunter's outfit on to hunt quail down here. You're going to be in the briars. You're going to bleed. I promise you.
That's a fact.
Our woodcock covers aren't always that way, but often are.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And you had mentioned Sharpies before. Where would you go for Sharptail?
So you got to start getting a little further west of there. So like central Kansas is the central part of the United States. It's the middle of the country. So from like that central part of Kansas on west. On into Colorado. I've hunted them as far west as Montana, both of the Dakotas, Kansas. Montana's beautiful. You kind of get out of pheasant country in Montana. There's still some pheasants, but they're going to be more like in your river bottoms and stuff.
You can kind of pick and choose where you're going to hunt your pheasants. And, you know, that's where most of my experience has been.
I love a pheasant as like a bonus bird, but you don't want to go get in South Dakota cattails with your young pointing dog.
No, I've done it. And I've had a ball. And I turned them all into flushing dogs.
You're still dealing with the repercussions of that with Crockett.
I know.
Crockett's like at 6 months old, I had him out and they were cutting the cornfield in pheasants and we were watching them fly over into the CRP. I mean, a dozen at the time. And we got, as we sat in the truck watching them fly, and we made our plan, three of us, to get out. We're going to work it this way and that way. We literally got out of the truck and all flushed a bird and went for retrieves and went in three different directions. And so did my dogs.
Yeah.
And I looked out at 600 yards, man, and you could just see pheasant popping like popcorn.
And Crockett was out there ripping on the shred. So
he was having a ball, I'm sure. And you know, it's funny. It's still in his brain, man. And you never know when it's going to come out in him, but for the most part, he's become a pretty honest dog now, but he's in his older age. But it is interesting. He's got a fire in his eye that every once in a while can be ignited, and the bird that's going to do it every time is going to be a pheasant, you know? Mm-hmm. So even when we're out on a preserve hunt or whatever, and he catches a little wind of a pheasant, he knows what he's got. So,
you know, when his mama comes back, she still does it on woodcock, and I haven't seen it to know for sure that it happens, but I can tell by the way she looks at me when she comes back that she's just going out wide about 150 yards and ripped her at least one. And then she'll come back in and do the rest of the hunt.
She just has to get it out of her, system. Yeah. Now, and that's fair. And that happens. And so I guess, you know, I've never hunted prairie chickens, and I'd say sharp tail of the bird I've had the most success on out west. That would be a kind of a, like your native bird. I've gotten into some huns, and we've had some really fun hunts on huns. But what I think I got most out of the sharp tail was they're not a bird that's going to tolerate pressure from a dog, but the dogs tend to learn to wind them at a good distance and get real cautious around them. And it's counterintuitive, but they handle really well for a dog. They just don't take a lot of proximity pressure.
That's exactly right, which makes them kind of a perfect bird for them because they tend to be in flocks or small groups. Will occasionally find singles and doubles. So they're leaving their ground bird. So they're leaving a good bit of ground scent, and they typically like short grass stuff, which to me kind of slows your dog down because they got a nose full and there's nowhere for it to hide. So they, you know, it's not a big wall of cover that they feel like they need to charge in to find it. They're like, okay, it's very near and I don't have a lot of room to move personally. And that bird has got to be, you know, right here.
Yeah. That's exactly been my experience. And to, you know, to that earlier point of, you know, you might find your pheasant in the river bottoms. I seemed like I was always, if I had a decent bottom that looked like a good place for a pheasant, it always felt like if I just jumped up on the bench, and I'm talking central Montana and eastern Montana is where I was spending most of my time, jumped up on the bench above that river bed or creek bed bottom, then there were likely going to be some sharp tails up there, especially depending upon the cover.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the time out that way, if there's a creek bottom, there's alfalfa fields, any of their hay or cattle feed type stuff is going to be down by those river bottoms or under irrigation. You're exactly right. You could literally step up the hill. And often we had some places where we hunted like that. We had four or five guys and multiple dogs. And we put a couple up on the ridge and then a couple are down there in the bottom.
Sure. Makes sense. Especially getting it done. So I guess, you know, let's just go by species here. So we got sharp tail, you know, the bird I felt like I got the most value out of for my dog in terms of stepping up that progression. And then I would say huns were probably a little more challenging, and I was finding those in similar areas. They tended to hang on the edges more where you'd get like transition into your alfalfa, from your other cover. I think they tend, you know, and I'm not an expert. I'm just going by my experience here. They tended to maybe run a little more or just be a little more crafty on the dog. But once you got them in singles, and we did hunt the singles out there, they were, you know, a little easier to manage. I don't know what your experience has been with.
Yeah, they're wily. And, you know, we kind of left the quail out of this since we're both southeastern based. The quail is not entirely unlike the sharp tail. What you run into with our wild quail now is if wild quail are hunted frequently and shot over sometime, they'll begin to hold better. Okay. You know, that's basically going to be on a plantation or private land type situation where you got your coveys and you know them. And things, it used to be that way for me back home. And now I just don't get the opportunity to do it as much. And the farming practices change. But so the quail is very similar to what the sharp tail is going to provide for you, although your covers are going to be different. But as far as the southeast goes.
Yeah. Now, what are you finding when you go to Kansas and you're finding your quail? Are they acting the same as you would expect a quail to act here at home on the ag fields, or
yeah,
are they different?
Yeah, well, very similar, but it's a different, it's a mix of ag and cattle land out there. So it's really kind of perfect. And they've got these great ditch rows and hedge and hardwood bottoms. And between and the eastern Kansas, from northeastern Kansas to, you know, anywhere southeast, all of eastern Kansas to the central part of the state has some really good tree cover and all before you get to the prairie lands. So it does. There's a lot of small plot type stuff. Like, gotcha. You know, kind of what the Southeast used to be set up, like 40-acre stuff with small cattle lots and just a lot of drains and terrains. And if there's a drain, it's unfarmable there, so something grows in it. So yeah. Just a lot of cover for them, a lot of food out there. It's grain country still, cattle lots, old farmsteads. There's just a lot of stuff. That's another good thing about quail and sharpies, too, is if there's not a lot of cover, you can look at it and you can kind of say, oh, well, if there are birds here, you know, they're highly likely to be in that. If you've got a young dog, you can set the wind in your favor, in the dog's favor, to approach that cover.
That's a really good point. I mean, and just in terms of, you know, when we talk about it in terms of hunting tactics, but they run pretty dang parallel to your, to just your good dog work tactics, is getting that young dog on the leeward side of a nice piece of cover, you know, and just, and letting them figure out, like you said, figure out objectives on their own. And it, whether you're talking ag field edges or tree lines, and you know what I'm thinking personally of Western Oklahoma, we had a good trip out there one year. And it was different country. It was a lot of kind of canyon type country, but you ended up with these plum thickets and stuff like that. And the birds like to move around those anywhere they were getting a break from the wind a little bit,
right?
And finding some vegetation where I'm assuming they're going to forage and get some insects and stuff like that as well. You know, but I think the major thing is those dogs everything you're seeing, the dogs figuring out in their own kind of sensory perception way.
Yeah. And we back that up to what we were talking about, the training introduction when they're young, when I'm teaching them to learn, when I'm doing those contrived setups, I'm using something that stands out that would potentially be an objective when we get to Kansas. So if my dogs get out of the truck and they see a plum thicket in the middle, you know, surrounded by grass and the rest of the field is fallow, you know, they're boogieing to that.
Yeah.
Because they already, I have taught them that that's where they'll find the prize, or they have learned through repetition with no pressure, just I'm hiding the Easter egg in what looks like a good spot every time.
Sure.
Kind of thing. Yeah. And then you set them up for success early. And then you set them up for success in the field. I think a lot of times, this is something we didn't touch on, is as a young hunter with a young dog or a newer bird dog, you want to go have that success right away. And you become more focused on shooting your birds than you do working your dog.
Yeah.
And you can create more havoc or you know, or set yourself back in training if you would leave that gun in the truck, let a buddy shoot. That sort of thing. Pick the right birds, pick the right terrain, pick the right wind direction when possible. That's not always going to be the case, but anytime you can choose to set the dog up for success versus yourself and the gun, that's what you should do.
Well, and I think it gets to, just another thing. So when we're back here hunting or training on pen raised birds, you know, one thing that's really important to me is with that young dog, you know, there's a point early on where you're helping them find birds. You're doing, you know, you're out there, you know, I'm always trying to not overhandle. Encouraging independence in my young dog. But if you're not careful, you'll kind of find yourself dragging your dog into birds, you're dragging your dog into objectives and odor and things like that. And these are those wonderful opportunities when you get out there on those wild birds, not to race your dog to an objective, but to set him up in such a manner that he figures it out on his own.
Right, with the bird doing all the work and you just following gleefully along behind.
And if you got dog, you know, and this is the thing, and I mean, to me, you know, and I've always told folks this, you know, when I get out there and I'm wild bird hunting, one thing I like to do is take my transmitter and zip it up or put it in a pretty tough place for me to access. you know, training on wild birds, you know, there's a time and a place to stop your dog, in wild birds. But I think, you know, especially if you're going out for the first time or early season with a young dog that's maybe only got a season or two under their belt, the best thing you can do is just put all that junk away and get out there and just walk.
That's another plus of the prairie.
Yeah.
If your dog leaves you 300 yards in the southern woods or in the Michigan woods, you got concern. In the prairie, you can see him going across the top knoll a half mile away and go, Lord, look at that fool. And they aren't going to catch those Sharpies. They're going to come back with their tongue hanging out, and then they're going to be ready to hunt your next covey because they're going to have gassed on chasing those birds nearly a mile.
Yeah, and I'll take a dog. I mean, it may be a dog that I've really managed my chase on, you know, and worked hard on managing chase. I like to use that term as opposed to removing chase. But I'll take them out to a place like that. And if they want to, and if they're up for chasing again, that's a place where I'm allowing it to kind of wind the clock back in their training. They're going to learn more from chasing those birds unsuccessfully, at least for a little while, before I go back to saying, okay, guys, it's time to reel it in and just be a little more cautious, you know? And I think there's real value, and especially, like you said, those sharp tails that they can see for a mile, and they
flap and glide right out in front of them. They're in no hurry to go. That, you know, they stay skyline where the dog can see them and not underneath them, but, you know, not too awfully far behind them. And, it really is. It's a great way. You're still promoting drive in your dog, and you're running some juice off of them. And Lord, mine need it. Well, I've got six of them. We've just traveled, you know, for 3 days across the country. They've been out no more than 10 or 15 minutes at the time. They need a couple of days of that before they get into a rhythm. So that's another thing, is don't go in with huge expectations on the first day. Go in to do that for 2 days.
That's a great point. So, you know, and I guess this is a bit of at least our experience helping guide maybe those with a little less. And I, again, my experience is pretty limited compared to yours, but I think, you know, man, obviously time is a virtue and very valuable to all of us. But if what you can do is spend 3 days out west, then just let those 3 days be a learning experience. Don't feel like if you come home with an empty cooler, you had a bad trip.
Yeah, you could make a dog in a trip. You can go out there and you can kill 10 quail and 3 pheasants and 2 Sharpies and still have your dog running fully amok. But if you go out there and you work on your dog and get them to handle those birds successfully, well, next year when you go back, then you can fill your bag with a steady dog. And I'm guilty of this. I'm preaching this, but I have a box full of dogs that have just been shot over. I grew up just, you know, unable to control myself until recently here. And so we're working. I got a couple of young dogs here that we're working on, and we're doing much better with them. We're not giving way to those urges like we've done before. And it's paid off. I mean, it's paid off huge amounts, just backing off pen race stuff, just enough for early introduction and, you know, and getting some basic handling skills in, and then trying to boogie out west or north or wherever the closest wild birds are to you. I keep using Kansas. That's just a reference. It's the central part of the country, and that's
they're gonna hate us in Kansas.
Yeah, so there's wild bird populations all over, some harder to get to than others, so anywhere that provides that type of setting.
And I mean, I guess we've, you know, hopefully driven that point home, you know, moving on up to what we find valuable. So to me, I think you nailed it, you know, woodcock into quail out there in the west somewhere, into sharptail, especially for me. Huns are good.
Yep.
I've hunted sage grouse successfully. I found them a pretty easy bird to hunt, and I know they're somewhat scarce as a resource. And so, you know, I think maybe there's some value if you've got a good sage grouse area and going out and hunting them, you know, or at least working dogs on them. But they're not, I think in the progression, you're getting as much jumping straight from your woodcock to your quail to your Sharpies or you know, keeping that order somewhat. And if you want to have a sage grouse hunt, keep that as a treat for yourself, just a special bird on occasion, because They were just, you know, the place I went was full of them, and they were, it was like hunting turkeys that wanted to sit like a woodcock.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a one and done bird for me. I got mine this year, and it was like that. At first I thought that we had Sharpies. Because where we were, but it was sage grouse, and they flushed, and a nice male popped up, and Ruthie had handled them perfectly. So I shot one, and I started not to then.
Yeah.
I didn't find them after them. That was my sage grouse, and I'm with you. That's a bird that needs to be protected right now. Really neat. If you want to do something with them, go watch them on their leks when they're mating.
Yeah. I mean, I thought they were beautiful and fun and interesting country to hunt in. I wasn't really happy with the table fare they provided. And I'm sure, you know, maybe I overcooked it or something, but it just wasn't the tastiest bird to me.
They're not that good, man.
So from there, I mean, there's other birds that's really kind of outside of grouse, and I haven't ever hunted blue or dusky grouse. I'd love to do that. That's one that's certainly on my list. And then chucker, I've never hunted in the wild, and that's another special bird. I know for the guys that are really into that, there's nothing you can make that you can satisfy them outside of chucker hunting with, you know.
Yeah, and that's one that I have not done yet. I've been in a little bit of chucker country. So we were in Montana this year, but man, the temperatures were up in the mid 70s, and everybody in each lunch space we stopped was telling us to be careful of the rattlesnakes. And when I got up in those rocky outcroppings, I was a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can see that too. And I think I'd like to make a trip to Utah or Nevada or Wyoming and those, or Idaho and the, you know, and those real classic chucker country areas.
Yeah, Idaho's on my bucket list, man.
Oh yeah. And Idaho's supposed to be just chock full of all sorts of wonderful game birds, and that'd be a wonderful trip too. So
yeah, Washington State, Oregon too. I hear fantastic things about there. It's just such a haul.
So I guess, you know, I mean, to bring it back around, we've discussed, I guess, our favorite birds for our dogs. We've been up and down that list, and that's two guys from the Southeast that are talking about going west. I mean, if we were in California, gosh, you'd got all sorts of quail.
Yeah, they got five species of quail, at least four out there.
Yeah. I mean, so those would be wonderful things. So, I mean, this is obviously, this is just coming based on what we have access to, what's easiest for us to do. And one day if lifestyle ever permits, I'll go try to get after all of them, including ptarmigan and everything else, you know, but for now, you know, I think Montana is kind of my western boundary as far as what I'd be willing to go do, make a big trip out of. And I think I can get whatever I need to get. I'm going to make it to Idaho one day. I'll certainly do my best to get everywhere I can and hunt. But I would like to touch on going north. I do, because I think if that's all you can do or you want to do, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I really prefer at times grouse and woodcock to anything, and that's where I want to be. And grouse can pose a challenge, but there's no reason your dog can't make that transition. Those woodcock are going to be easier for them to handle, but eventually they'll figure your grouse out if you stick with it. And I've had some success with Pete, and certainly Lottie. You were there for her putting on her little clinic when she figured them out.
Yeah, she's sharp.
Yeah, you know. And so I'd say definitely your birdier bird dogs, your pointier bird dogs, more cautious by nature, are gonna be a little better. I think, I'm sure that's why the setters and the like tend to be what people prefer for that. But they're worth going and chasing and having a good time.
Well, I agree as a whole that setters are probably the primary grouse dog. And I'm sure I could get argument from 10 different directions on this.
And there's killer short hairs and killer pointers. And I mean, pointers in particular.
But, yeah. Well, I was going to speak on Colin Johnston and John Drummond Lawrence, those guys, and Dean Thiessen. Yeah. And there are lots of others. I'm just most familiar with these three guys. You know, they run a grouse camp up out of Amasa, Michigan, and they grouse hunt every single day of both seasons. Now, Colin, I think, leaves for the colder season, but is there fooling guides every day with French Brittany's exclusively with a huge amount of success. And I hunted with Colin one day and his dog Onyx. He says, all right. They said, if Onyx points, he said, just keep walking in front of him. Just keep walking. He's like, do not stop walking. Keep walking. And I'm like, all right, I get it. You know, I hunt enough. Well, I'm 30 yards past Onyx and he's still locked on point. And I turn around and look back at Onyx and 20 yards beyond me, two grouse flush on up the road where, and Onyx just looked at me, shook his head and came on back around and got up front again. And Colin said, I told you to keep walking. I didn't know 65 yards. The dog had a nose that long.
I have judged that dog, and he's a special animal. He's got so much nose, and he's such a cautious dog. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of that's his good breeding, and a lot of it is Colin. You know, Colin lives in Texas a lot of the rest
trains
of the year.
Trains exclusively on wild birds.
Yeah, and that's it. His dogs only ever get access to wild birds, and it shows. And I've judged them on pen raised birds, and they treat those pen raised birds like they're wild birds. And it's a special thing to watch, and you can see it immediately, and you know what you're looking at when you do.
Yeah, well, so, I put a deposit on the Onyx pup. I'll be picking her up in about a month.
Sweet. I'll be looking forward to seeing that. So I guess, you know, I mean, there's folks out there listening that have access to other birds. And if you do, you know, and you want to give us some feedback on what you think the virtues of your dogs are for helping train a bird dog, let me know. I want to touch on what you got planned for this season. So you've always traveled, and we've talked a little bit about maybe sending some client dogs with you. Where are you standing with that?
Yeah. So I've got a dog box on the truck. I think my capacity is around 10 dogs. So I would look to carry somewhere between 3 and 5 client dogs or individuals' dogs that they would want exposed to wild birds. I have to look. I don't have my schedule right here in front of me, but they can contact me. We'll put my contact information up at the end of this, or you can reach out to Grayson and I'll get you my schedule. But I leave somewhere in October, and we have not determined yet exactly where Destination North is, but we're looking Pennsylvania, New York, New Hampshire, Vermont way. And we may not be able to hunt in each of those states, but we would probably try to. If you stop in each state and hunt like that, it allows the dogs, you know, a day or two on the ground, and you do a travel day or half day travel and you hunt them. And what I would do is try and get all the dogs out and get them wild bird exposure daily, weather and travel permitting. And we hadn't exactly determined what a price would be on that. There's a lot of responsibility taking someone's dog up the road.
And to that point, you know, I was kind of looking at this as being something that would be really good for my existing clients, you know, and dogs that I'm comfortable with already and would be comfortable handling off the stump, knowing that they'd handle for them. And it wouldn't be a huge learning curve for the dog. I don't think this is a program you want to send your dog that's never even been off a leash or anything like that on. You know, you'd be wanting a more experienced bird dog that you'd be comfortable having in somebody else's hands down in wild country. And so, you know, for me, there's a few clients that have already expressed interest in doing this, and I know the type of dog, but if you've got an interest in this and you're not quite sure, you can reach out to me. We can discuss it and maybe we can kind of come up with a plan for you. And whether that be a dog come to me for a little bit or whatever and get exposure to stump and we get some handle on that dog and get them ready for this kind of trip. But I think the clients I have had express interest, we're talking about sending that dog out with stump and maybe flying to a destination and meeting and spending a day or two on the ground with their own dog.
Yeah, that's the way I'd like to do it. I'd like to meet every owner and every dog and qualify them and have them qualify me so that everybody's comfortable with what's going on. There'd be I'm not a huge technical guy, poster and that sort of thing, but I'd provide daily updates. And be available when service allowed for you to talk to me during the time while your dogs are with me. But right now we're looking at 2 different trips, each around 3 to 4 weeks each. I think November one may go on a little longer into December, and then possibly another one in January. And we would be hunting and training, depending on the level of your dog, daily on different birds.
So that's, yeah. I mean, so for those of you listening that, and I'm sure it's most of you, it's me for sure. And I wish I could take this trip with you, and I'm going to try and catch you somewhere on the road at some point. And visit and hunt while we're out there. You know, but what this does is it takes, you know, a dog that you may not have the time to get that kind of exposure on and gives it to them. And that's pretty invaluable. So I think there's a ton of value in this. It does, it needs to be the right situation. Obviously it needs to be the right kind of owner, and we need to develop a rapport, you know, between you and the owner. And obviously I'll play whatever role I can in that. But you know, like I said, if you got an interest, something you can reach out on.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. And I've done some of this in the past with friends' dogs and friends of friends' dogs, and it's worked out well. We have done sort of location hunts where I've rented an Airbnb. We have extra rooms, usually within 3 hours of an airport. So you could just fly in and drive to what our location is. Your lodging would be included. We have the fridge stacked, and your dog would be there waiting on you.
That sounds pretty awesome. So I mean, because it's, and I guess this year would be kind of the beta version of that. And I think it doesn't pay to try and put too many limitations on it or too many expectations up front right now. It's just, like I said, I think it's important for that person to get to know you. I'll facilitate that however I can, you know, thinking probably folks in the Southeast or folks that would be willing to travel down here before that program and get to, at the very least, shake hands and let me or you get hands on their dog and just have a nice long, you know, get to know each other session.
Yeah, that's right. Just some recalls. Good. And make sure we don't have a bolter or anything like that. The dogs will be well taken care of. I change the hay out regularly in the box. We'll have straw in the box. Dogs stay in the box at night. They're out during the day, either hunting in the box or on the chain gang. So they're with me 100% of the time. They're never left alone or anything like that. So.
Yeah. No, that's all good. And that's road. That's how it works on the road with all of us for the most part. And so, and there's definitely a skill to traveling with a bunch of dogs, that you can't really learn without doing it. And luckily you've put a lot of years in.
Yeah, I've logged a few miles with dogs. Not every dog, but it's a good opportunity for a dog's eyes to open up to the wide world, you know, to see what it's about. And if you can get into heavy bird numbers in good years, you really can make a bird dog out there in a much shorter amount of time than you will any other way.
Yeah, for sure. So for those of you with an interest in that, reach out, and we'll just at least start talking, start thinking about it and figuring it out as we go, but making sure we do it safely and effectively. And that's the most important thing. And, you got anything else to add to that in particular? There's a few things I want to touch on before we get off, but I think we're kind of,
no, that's really it. You know, that's in development, and I'm open to ideas and suggestions from individuals that you speak with about how they see it working best for them. And, we could dial all that in on a per person basis. So just get in touch with us on that.
Okay. All right. And so moving on, projects you got in the works right now. I know there's probably some secret stuff you don't want to talk about too much at the moment, but, anything you do want to discuss?
Yeah. Well, you came down and we shot a pilot for a television show that we've decided to call Backroads and Bird Dogs. It's just based around what we talked about, the culture of bird dogs, with some training tips, travel tips, a lot of the stuff that you cover on your podcast. And hopefully it'll give you a voice for some of the stuff you're doing on your podcast to also be seen on YouTube and Pursuit Network initially. We're still in the editing stages of that, but we've got good response on the previewing of the footage that's been collected. Pursuit's definitely interested once we get it put together. Next would be us collecting sponsors. So anybody out there that might want to jump on board with something like this, there'd be ad opportunities for television and all other social media outlets. So that'll be Backroads and Bird Dogs. Just hang 10 while we get it all put together. It's a process and not all of it's in our control. But that's coming up. We have bred Ruthie, which is a Eula pup, a Eula Pete pup.
Yep.
And to Fred's dog, Fred Overby's dog, Sasquatch. She appears to have taken. We'll have pups mid-April on the ground, like April 15th is due date. So we have not advertised or marketed these yet. I've got a few people on the waiting list. I expect a smaller litter. But anyway, again, something you can contact me or Grayson about.
I guess that's an opportunity. I do want to talk about Ruthie. And, you know, I've got Reggie right now has been bred to Natty. I think, and I'm expecting a smaller litter as well. And I've taken six deposits and I'm not going to take any more, and I'm hoping we make all that. There's a good chance we won't. You know, we're talking smaller frame bitches. They're both in standard, but just barely. I think we're on the precipice of a very special line of dogs, and that Pete Eula Nick has been just on fire. You know, every single one of the offspring I've seen has been a very nice dog, and very well-rounded. So I'm just so hopeful for the future and so excited for the future with this line, because I think, you know, the French Brittany is a breed that I love and cherish. But it's not without its shortcomings in certain areas and things we need to work on. And I feel like that Nick just got us right where I want to be right now.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see these puppies. I told you I ordered a pup from Onyx, and it's going to be hard not to keep one of these Ruthie pups, but it's also going to be hard to stay married if I keep piling French Brittany's up in here. But yeah, if these pups turn out great, if we find that we can keep this steady going, I really do think we've got a ton of retrieving these dogs. These dogs tend to be a little more accepting of pressure than some of the others, and their feelings aren't hurt so much. Which you're right. There's a balance in there, but that's also one of the good things about the French Brittany is they can train a little different, being a little softer. But yeah, if we keep that going, we've got something special here. The last two litters have been phenomenal. If these two can come out like their parents and siblings did,
I feel like I've gone through so many that I just didn't quite like well enough to keep and keep in the program, you know, over the last 7 years, and it's been just a real chore, and I feel like there's been a lot of bad luck on my end as far as that's concerned too. But I love Reggie to death. I think she's a fine example of an EB, and I know Ruthie is as well. And we've got Oakley out there, and Stout, and Rona, and who else? There's several.
Rush.
Rush is killing it. And what we're getting back to is we made this cross. We made two breedings between my dog Pete. That's Lost Highway's Noble Pete. And he is from my original EB Ella, bred to Atos, who's Jackie Huttwagner's dog that's just killed it in everything he's ever done.
He's a badass.
He's a killer dog. There's a really special story to go along with Atos as well. And gosh, we would be on here too long. But for those of you with a real interest in French Brittany's, there's several good places to get them in the country. There's a few that aren't so good. And it would pay for you to do a little research. And I never want to badmouth anybody on this thing. And I haven't paid attention to the ones I don't like that much, but I'd certainly be happy to point you in the direction of the people that I think are producing quality EBs these days. It's really important that we take these dogs and we not only hunt the wheels off of them and love them as much as we can in a family environment, but show them off, you know. And Eula is Stump's dog that is one of my favorite EBs that's ever existed too. And boy, they hit a real perfect nick for us. So for those of you out there interested, definitely link up with us on a puppy if you're looking for one. And if you want to get one, they need to be going to hunting homes at a minimum. I'd love to see them in trials and hunt tests. And Pete's got a VC and NAVDA. Eula's a killer water dog. And I want to keep those traits in the gene pool as best we can. And so hoping you guys will be out there working them in those kind of ways if you do get them.
Yeah. And if you get a dog from me, and most breeders are this way, I think those first 3 months are hugely important with a puppy. And we didn't touch on much of those early stages other than introductions and all of that. But there's a lot you can do to bolster a pup's confidence when they're young. And that could be a whole nother podcast. But exposure to everything, to people, to noises, to different locations, to a leash when they're really young, to a crate. You know, get all that started early, and you're teaching that dog's mind to handle things and to grow and to learn to learn.
And you know, to that point, I think you and Megan, you certainly do a better job than I do, and I give it a good effort. But that first 8 weeks of life, you guys, you know, your whelping box time with those pups is the best I've ever seen. You know, they're not just that they're getting handled, they're being stimulated in ways that just other puppies aren't. And it's, I think you really see, the back end of that when you get your younger pup and he's so well adjusted, or she's so well adjusted and ready to take on the world. So, you know, I don't know who else is out there. I don't know a whole lot about all the other breeding programs out there, but I can certainly speak to yours in that regard. And I'm looking forward. Gosh, I'm so excited, man, if I can't keep one of my own, I know they're going into a couple of homes where I'm going to be able to keep a real close eye on them. And we'll keep pushing the ball down the field as far as this line is concerned.
Yep. They should be good ones.
So, well, that's all I think I've got. We've been at it for about an hour and 20 minutes. I think we definitely need to do this again. And I know there may be a potential that you'll be having your own podcast at some point that's going to run parallel to the show. And I'll look forward to joining you on that at some point as well. But I definitely want to have you back. I mean, I feel like we touched on so many things that we could dive so much deeper on. And I think hopefully folks are going to get as much out of this as I feel like I am currently. Couple things I want to mention about you. You know, if you're interested in just getting to know Stump a little better, you can catch him. He is the MC of the King Cat tournament trail. Am I getting that right?
Yep. I've been promoted. I'm the national director and the MC of the King Cat tournament trail, currently hosted by Johnny Mars, Bass Pro Shops, Cabela's. And awesome. We travel the country doing catfish tournaments. You can find me there. You can find me online on Facebook at Pauly's Island Guide Service, or my personal page, Kevin Stump Grant. On the web, it's paulysislandguideservice.com. And my cell number, should I put that out there?
No, I'm not sure I'd do that. Yeah. Who knows? But you
can find it on any one of those places.
Yeah. Make them do a little extra work to get to it. Just to go find him at his website, and certainly look him up on King Cat so you can see that perfectly symmetrical face to go along with that silky smooth voice you hear.
Face for radio. Podcast.
but I've enjoyed this conversation so much, Stump, and I look forward to getting back out there with you before too long. I know we'll see each other before long. And
yeah, you're coming fishing.
I know it's going to be a good time. And folks, you know, stay in touch with us. If we can do anything to help you, or you're interested in one of these programs, you know, we're still working out the kinks and figuring out how it's going to work. But what I can tell you is we're not going to do anything haphazardly. Safe and effective is the only way to go forward with it. So that's all I've got currently. You know, as always, my sponsors for this show are Lost Highway Kennels. And I guess now you could add Pauly's Island Guide Service and Hokum Poke Bretons to that. And that's it. So, you know, if you're looking for a snake aversion clinic, I got one coming up April 29th. And anything else you need to know, you can probably find on my website or just by reaching out to me. Same goes for Stump. Buddy, it's been great talking to you, man.
Yeah, Grayson, thanks for having me on, man. And I'll come back anytime. Just let me know.
I'll do it, man. All right, we'll talk to you later.
See you.
Hey, listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Birdshot Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Birdshot Podcast today. We'll be right back.